Justin Burnett gets the block on Williams. Disrespecting gravity, and Atlanta converts.
The pressure was building through that entire defensive point.
And the Atlanta Hustle have knocked off the two-time defending UFA champions, 20-15.
Welcome back. It's Swing Pass. The Empire has fallen as New York's record-setting 31-game winning streak was snapped on Saturday night in Atlanta as the Hustle come up with the big Super Series win and a tectonic shifting result. There were eight other games on the weekend, but Cam, I want to get to the big tent issue. Atlanta upsetting, in a way, I think. We'll talk more about that as we get into the game. Upsetting the previously undefeated, hadn't lost since September 11th, 2021, New York Empire. It was a top-down win for the Hustle. I would say their most impressive in their franchise's history, including over the one in which they beat the New York Empire in the 2021 regular season, the last time New York lost during the regular season. What were your big reactions from this epic matchup?
Yeah, I mean, we should have seen this coming, right? It was Star Wars Day, the Empire falls. I mean,
people were saying online that it was scripted because of that.
It does make for a kind of a fun story. I mean, my initial impressions were, you know, I kind of have to go with what Brett Holzmeier said in the post game. He was right. In the first half, Atlanta's offense didn't necessarily look great. They held and they converted. But there was a lot of, you know, kind of uncertainty in a lot of those possessions, some very high stall counts. But you know what? The Empire O-line, it's broken. That was my biggest takeaway. The Empire O-line is completely broken. We can talk more about why, but I even went back and watched because I was like, maybe it wasn't as broken as I thought it was. No, it actually looked worse on a rewatch than it did in my initial impression. So we'll get into more about why I think that is. But it was very just shocking at how inept the O-line looked for New York pretty much all night until they kind of started to figure out the zone in the second half and clip through a little bit.
I mean, I'm going to go ahead and disagree with you because as paltry as their offensive performance, I think the real, oh no, there might be some trouble for this Empire team was the fact that they didn't get a break until there was 3 minutes left in the game or 90 seconds or something, and it was well out of reach. I mean, that was a total garbage time conversion for a New York defense that almost set a league record last year for break rate. I mean, I was looking at the stats. Through two games, New York has a 19% break rate. That's the sixth lowest in the league. The teams that are beneath them are Pittsburgh's and Detroit's and Portland's. I mean, this isn't the class where the Empire is supposed to reside in this league. And that has been the backbone. I mean, we've talked extensively for as star-studded and superstar-oriented as the New York offense has been, their sort of success has been because of their consistency. And obviously now down a couple MVPs, that's changing. But the backbone of New York's title runs has felt like their defense, their ability to deny offenses from kind of implementing their plan A. And while I hear you, I hear Holzmeier as far as there was some trepidation. I mean, sure, it's still a good defense in New York, but Atlanta just kind of got to their spots. I mean, Bobby Lay was crushing it from deep. Holzmeier finished without a turnover. Everyone kind of got their touches. I mean, and to speaking to that, the top seven yardage producers for the Hustle on Saturday night, five combined turnovers. Like, that is excellence from your offense, and it was such a turnaround given where Atlanta was in week one in Carolina. I mean, I know we talked about the return of Matt Smith and sort of how he grounds this unit, but everybody on that Hustle O just tuned up a notch. I don't know if it was the coach Tuba Benchinjaja and his staff kind of reorienting things during the week, if it was just players engaging more. That looked like a fundamentally different version than we saw in week one and a return to where Atlanta was last year when they won 10 regular season games and hosted the division title game. You know, like, that's a damn good offense with a lot of balance. they're fine grinding out possessions, but if you forget that they have Draco Taylor and Bobby Lay tossing bombs from the backfield, they'll remind you. And again, like, Lay is just such a special talent when he gets in that zone and can just apply pressure with his throws. I thought it was so interesting as kind of a redo from Hustle's 2021 regular season win when they were making all the big plays. They did it again on Saturday night. The other name we're getting too long before we mention, Justin Burnett. I mean, he took the Jack Williams matchup and basically negated Williams from being a playmaker all night long. While on the flip side, he had the 3 to 4 most emphatic plays of the night and was kind of the bell ringer for Atlanta's Undertaker role.
And you're leaving off a name that I think was also just really crucial and offensively, Jeremy Langdon. Like, Langdon.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, Langdon was such a linchpin.
He was so good in this game. Like, I really thought that, not that he wasn't going to add anything. Like, that's not where I'm going with this. But, like, I really thought the biggest impact on offense in terms of returning was going to be Matt Smith just kind of getting those easy passes to Matt Smith for 10, 15 yards here or there, which they were missing so much in their first week. But Jeremy Langdon actually, to me, was like maybe outside of Bobby Lay and his massive throws, as impactful as anyone on that O-line. Like, of course, Brett Holzmeier is going to have his, but the plays that Langdon was making from start to finish, whether it was in the deep space or whether it was getting disc in his hands, whatever, I was really impressed. I thought it was actually a game where I almost forgot a little bit about Austin Taylor and Christian Olsen. Not that they weren't involved, but like the big plays were coming from everyone else. But you know, you talked about the defense for New York and how they struggled. Their break rate is super low. I think it just all feeds
five blocks.
It feeds off of each other, right? Like you,
yes.
The offense struggling is feeding into the defense struggling. Cause one of the things that New York has done so well during their 31-game win streak was you knew that their offense was going to score with a level of consistency that was going to be at the top of the league. So it just ramped up the intensity and the pressure you felt on offense of needing to hold. And that just doesn't exist this year. I feel like offenses are going to be able to play so much more loosely against their defense because they're not having to worry about this record-setting offensive efficiency on the other side. And I think it's all just going to play into each other where both sides' struggles are going to affect the others. And I think the defense is being adversely affected by how much the offense is struggling.
Yeah, no, I was actually talking about that with somebody else this weekend about how it's this awful scenario where they're both feeding off of each other as they underperform. Like, that's simply the way in which, you know, it's sort of the intangible element of the entire sport is that the lines do feed off of each other despite how much they are separated in the literal playing formation on the field, right? Like, if your offense isn't able to stay on the field and your defense keeps on having to be out there, that's tough. That's going to wear you down over time. On the flip side, if your defense can't get breaks at all, your offense just keeps on having to go out there, it puts a lot of pressure on each of those possessions. And you could see the strain in New York's system, you know. The backfield was just a miss, you know. It doesn't look where it's been the past few years. Elliot Chartok returned after missing week one for the Empire, and him and Solomon Ruschmeyer-Bailey were just a step off from each other in their first game together of the 2024 season. And Atlanta's handler defense was great. They had a great kind of fastball changeup, schematic adjustment of one-on-one coverages versus zone. It felt like they knew exactly when to deploy each version against this Empire offense. And I think the most glaring part, and we were talking about this over the weekend in the pregame prep, is the lack of New York explosives. Obviously, that's headlined by the loss of the MVPs, Babbitt and Osgar. But just even aside from that, we expected this team to be able to punch, and it's just not there. I mean, the Atlanta defense effectively plucked the wings off of this Empire offense and made them just do boring, methodical drives against zone looks and like some mid-range passes. New York can't establish a deep game. They have the second worst huck percentage through the first 2 weeks of the season of any team in the league. It's at 36%. And obviously, again, the big underlined item of that is missing Ryan Osgar, who is the most efficient and highest volume deep thrower in the league the past three seasons. But man, this drop off, this inability to make highlights, like to just, I don't mean highlights in the sense of, wow, that's impressive, but in the sense of like, yeah, let's go here. Let's get some momentum. There's just no spark. It's odd.
It's a stark departure from where we've been and where the Empire have been basically since like what, the start of the 2019 season. If we want to take it all the way back that far, where they've kind of always had this big three or big four, you know, back in.
Well, it's more like big seven. It was like a big seven.
So you can go a number of different directions with this, but like there are so many things wrong with this offense right now. And you mentioned like, if you look, they had so much trouble against Atlanta's person defense because they just don't have the explosiveness to get open. You talked about
they can't create separation.
No, the breaking things of emergency.
They have good
John Randolph, right?
They're good players. I don't want to mince words here. Like, the New York offense is still really solid, has a lot of good pieces. The Sean Keegan addition is going to be a stabilizing presence on their offense. But without Yacht and Jack Williams playing at the levels that we're used to, there's no ability to stretch the field right now. It's a lot of stable passes, but a good defense like Atlanta can tee off on it. You saw when New York would sort of make a half-hearted reset attempts, the Hustle were all over that. I mean, Burnett just blew stuff up in the lane if you were half-assing it. And there's a lot more lackadaisicalness. There's a step out of rhythm. It's different.
there was like some notable throwing mistakes from every person on that O-line too. It was across the board. I mean, and it was not even on hard stuff. I mean, it's Jack Williams throwing a continuation backhand at Liam Haberfield's ankles. It's Solomon Ruschmeyer Bailey not stepping around to throw a disc to Jack Williams. So he throws it high and inside and Justin Burnett gets a run through D like that. He didn't really have to make that great of a play on. Like, it's things like that happen throughout the game. It's a timeout followed up by Liam Haberfield sending a huck into outer space. I mean, it's so uncharacteristic for a team that has been so composed and so poised in situations where games were tight. They were always able to make the right decision, to execute at the highest level. And we're seeing a complete collapse of that in this game. But really, if you go back to the Montreal game, we saw signs of it there too. They moved John Randolph to offense because they need some athleticism and some speed and something to threaten the defense. Ben Yacht looks afraid to catch a disc in the air over a defender. He made some really nice defensive plays in this game, had a nice layout D, I believe, in the first quarter that saved a break for Atlanta, had a good D between a couple of Atlanta defenders. I think it was late in the third or early in the fourth on a cross field shot. But on offense, he's not even making contact with the disc on some of these. It's going over his hand. I mean, he hasn't been able to get open. And this is a guy who has been about as explosive and playmaking of an athlete as we've had in the league for the past, five, six seasons. And he just looks, the aura is gone, as you put it, that aura of like Ben Yacht, the cockiness, the bravado, the confidence that he's just going to win his matchup. It seems like it just doesn't exist anymore. And I don't know what to attribute that to. I don't have any like data to drive this, but it's gone.
One of the things that has been a little undersold or maybe under talked about New York is that one of the places in their franchise that they've mortgaged away in pursuit of this win streak and multiple championships, which is exactly what you should do, is developing younger talent. They're an older team. They might be the oldest team in the league this year, especially as they continue to add a few more veterans to plug some of these holes. And so I think we're seeing almost like what we saw in 2019 with Madison, as a team coming off of a championship, taking maybe some of those offseason workouts a little bit more lightly, having a lot of roster turmoil heading directly into the season, and you're just not at the same level as all of the opponents who spent their off seasons with your photo tacked to the back of their squat rack, right? Like, that's where Atlanta has been. They've been preparing for this matchup. New York, I mean, they did, but it didn't work, and there weren't really any adjustments once Atlanta kind of settled in and said, oh, we know our strengths in this game. You know, like, I mean, this Hustle team just matches up well with it, with New York. Like, you were talking about Langdon. That is kind of that matchup that New York defensively has been so successful attacking. They'll put a Drost brother or even offside Jeff Holm or somebody, like this big athletic defender who can be a little bit more physical and sort of bully a little bit one of your 5-7 lineup players. Well, for Atlanta, that happened to be Jeremy Langdon. Jeremy Langdon's shoulders are made of titanium. Like, if there's one player in this league who can take a little bit of a bullying and give it back, it's Jeremy Langdon, man. Like, that guy can rise to a level that few players can. And while he's, you know, getting up into his 30s, has a family, whatever, like, Saturday night, he showed you exactly what he can add to a lineup in a game like that. Like, zero turnovers, over 19 yards a touch. A handful of scores when he finished with 5 total, I think. Yeah, he had 2 assists, 3 goals, and just being that reset valve, being available, being that matchup that they can go win down lineup and not just have to over-rely on Holzmeier, not have to just only look on the Bobby Ley deep shots. Yeah, man, like, Atlanta, what a weak turnaround for Atlanta. 8-goal loss to Carolina, 5-goal win against the reigning champs, knocking off their record. I mean, hats off to again, like, Tuba Bench and Jaja and that coaching staff. I thought there was some great color and analysis from the broadcast team of Evan Leppler and Brian Jones on Saturday night about Tuba and kind of where he came into this league with the Cannons, some of these Hustle players playing for him back then. 2015, they were basically an offensive hold and just passing the clock out, away from making championship weekend against the Flyers. And an unfortunate turnover resulted in Carolina instead taking the South Division's first ever championship weekend bid. And ever since then, for as good as a coach as Tuba has been in this league, there's just always been a little bit of heartbreak, obviously headlined by last year's South Division title game. And it's so cool to see this team that's sort of been building towards stuff like this for the past few years get a win like that. And then also, we've been dogging on New York. I mean,
yeah, we need to give Atlanta their flowers. Man.
Well, not only that, but, like, let's give New York flowers. They just won 31 damn games in a row. I mean, the last time that a team did this, it was in a completely different era of the league.
100%.
Toronto accomplished their own impressive streak. I mean, not to take too much away, but New York winning 31 straight games, including 2 titles in that stretch, is just, I don't entirely have words, and I think that as tough of a loss as that was for the Empire, it deserves absolute, like, parade-level kind of admiration for the discipline, commitment, mm-hmm. and the core of that franchise and team. And it's, again, it's unfortunate that, like, when it falls apart really dramatically, and I'm really curious to see how a championship-level team like this responds and how other teams now attack them with their vulnerabilities. But, man, like, we spent some time talking about Yacht. Like, Yacht's been there the entire time, man. Jack Williams has been there the entire time. Dross, like, Marquez Brownlee, Antoine Davis, like, all those guys. John Randolph, everyone involved in this. And some of the people who was left, too, you know, like, tremendous accomplishment. Again, historical. I would say the pinnacle sort of team achievement this league has ever seen. And we'll be lucky to see another sort of streak like this. And they're not going anywhere, you know? Like, it took Atlanta's, like, best game as a franchise and New York underperforming, and it still kind of felt like, to Holzmeier and your point at the start of this segment, like, New York could have gotten back into that. They had their opportunities, and it'll be interesting to see if, as they kind of play into shape over this long season, if they now have coal in the furnace to fire up on.
Shout out to Ethan Fortin, only person to play in all 31 of those games.
Oh, nice.
So, special shout out to him. He was a part of every single one of those on the field, which is, I mean, that is almost 3 seasons straight worth of games in terms of regular season, I suppose. Now,
to say nothing of the conditioning and workouts and everything that goes into staying on the field for 31 straight games.
Yeah.
Like,
so a lot of people that have played in this league for a long time have never played 31 straight games. So for him to do it, yeah, this win streak, it is impressive. I want to get back to Atlanta a little bit. We had Bobby Ley can be kind of a, you know, Jekyll and Hyde occasionally with his throwing performances, but I feel like over the last season plus, we've seen a lot more Jekyll, a lot less Hyde. Like, he's just been really good. And in this game, he was fantastic. Not looking forward to having to go against his crossfield throws when he comes to an indoor environment in Indianapolis. That sounds really not fun. I can only imagine the types of throws he's going to be putting up then. But we talked about their game last week and how they were kind of missing that mid-range game, that short game, to get to the hucking game. And they were so good in this game. It almost was like they were waiting and biding their time until, like, New York's defense got tired, and then they would take their shot. Because if you go back and watch a lot of their deep shots, they were coming like 45 seconds to a minute into a point. They were just kind of piddling around, bouncing around, short gainer, short loss, short gainer, short loss, and eventually, boom, Huck opened up. And that is really what Atlanta wants to be doing. They don't want to be trying to necessarily blow the top off the defense 15 seconds into a point. And I thought that that patience that they showed and kind of being a little more selective with those shots is what is one of the reasons they were so successful on offense. They really didn't try to force too much. They did force a couple of throws. They were kind of bailed out by some foul calls. Not that they weren't necessarily fouls, but like they weren't good looks. They were lucky to get fouled to kind of retain possession. But for the most part, those deep shots were coming to open receivers with open throwing lanes, and the defense didn't have a chance at them. And so kudos to the Atlanta O-line, but also kudos to their D-line, because their D-line looked fantastic on a turnover. They were really smooth with most of their movement. Justin Burnett was, you know, just all over the field making plays, but it wasn't just him. He got a lot of the blocks, and he had that one just vicious sky over to Empire players. But it was really the whole defense. There was pressure all over the field. If you go back and rewatch that game, there just aren't New York receivers open up field. Like, they just, if you're wondering why they were just swinging the disc and losing so many yards all the time, it's because no one's open. And so kudos to that whole, both lines, like their zone line that certainly slowed things down and gave them a different look, but their man line was really just giving New York the business the whole night.
Another shout out, long time Hustle veteran. He might've been on 2015. I think he was Trenton Spinks. He came up with the kind of a rabbit out the hat Callahan off of the Elliott Chartok deflection. Just one of those moments early in the game where you go, oh, New York might lose this. They don't do stuff like that. He came up with that Callahan, which is a little bit of right place, right time. But man, he had a layout block at the end of the first quarter on a buzzer beater attempt from Ben Yacht into the end zone. Great hustle play. And just to your point, there was little airspace. A lot of coverage sacks from that Atlanta defensive unit. Big, big, impressive showing from them. It just felt like they kept action in front of them all night. And they knew exactly where their matchups were. They were content taking everything as it came to them. Another aspect, I know it was a foul, but it's getting so much buzz. That Jakeem block, that bounce he had where he almost went over the head of a former Atlanta player, Liam Aberfield. I haven't seen him clear that kind of height since 2017, pre his Achilles injury. He looks good, man. And again, it was just one of those moments where you're like, man, Atlanta's making plays. They are confident against this New York team. It's going to be a new season, man.
I heard that Jakeem just landed just now. He finally came back to Earth.
Getting reports he landed somewhere in the Pacific. There will be recovery crews out to get him momentarily. But yeah, he came back out of orbit. I mean, he did a Jumpman logo on him. Like, he's straight up like 40 plus inches in the air, high pointing a disc that's top of backboard level. Man, that was impressive. That was a statement win. And now it's like, and now New York and Atlanta both get into the teeth of their matchups. I mean, the Hustle already face a rematch with Carolina in this upcoming Week 3 game of the week. So they go right back to another championship contender. And honestly, the team that to this point has still looked like the most impressive 2024 version of itself, the Flyers. Mm-hmm. Like, their 8-goal win over Atlanta in Week 1 certainly looks impressive now. We should move on to the other 8 games, and we can kind of even touch a little bit back on this epic New York and Atlanta event. But I wanted to get to the rest of the Week 2 sort of slate and get to some scores. Most importantly, I think we'll start with the reigning West Division champions, last year's runner-up, and the first team to reach three wins in 2024, Salt Lake, taking care of business on their road trip through Southern California with a 19-17 win over San Diego on Friday. It's pretty close. And then an impressive 23-20 hold off of LA on Saturday. Excuse me. Once again, Salt Lake now moves to 3-0 with their wins over DC, San Diego, and LA. They will be off in week three, but then they have another big road trip doubleheader in week four at Oakland, at Colorado. Jordan Kerr, in case you were curious, so far through three games, 12 assists, 4 goals, 2 blocks, 83 of 85 on throws. He's got 2 throwaways in 3 games and over 1,000 yards of offense. So, yeah, I think we have an MVP front runner so far. And then, you know, Salt Lake, every year it feels like they just add another X-factor offensive weapon. Last year it was Jace Dunabile, the league's most improved player. This year it looks like rookie Ben Field. He's got 6 assists, 7 goals, is second on the team in total yardage through their first three games, and has just been confident moving out around there. He can kind of step back into the backfield. He's got a hand cannon on him. He's athletic. He can move downfield as a receiver. I mean, the Salt Lake team was without Grant Lindsley on Friday night. He played on defense on Saturday when he did join them. They didn't have Will Selfridge. The offense looked pretty much like it always does. Again, as we see elsewhere in this league, having offensive line absences can really impact you, even one or two, and this shred machine just continues to churn forward. So an impressive week two set of games for them. Elsewhere, Glory moved to 2-0 after their 8-goal win over Toronto at home. Boston averaging 13 blocks a game through their first two matchups of the season. Reigning MVP Jeff Babbitt, 6 goals, 5 blocks in one turn. He had all 5 of those blocks in week one, so not as impressive, but he still sits near the top of the league after that amazing debut that he had. The reigning champions from the South, Austin, getting a big 25-14 win over Houston. The Havoc were hanging around through the first half or so of that game, and then the Soul defense just started to roll. Also, the Soul offense looks, again, pretty darn good. I know last year they struggled with some of their efficiencies, but that is a unit to really watch. I just think, you know, sort of in contrast to New York, a lot of explosives on the Soul offense. We have Swiatek, Kyle Henke, Duncan Fitzgerald, Mark Evans ripping deep. A lot of good targets in that system. Elsewhere, Seattle had a tough road trip, but they get their first road win over a team with a winning record since 2017 last Friday night in their 1-goal victory over Oakland. Looked like Cascades were going to kind of walk away with that one. And once again, the Spiders, on just sort of some kind of dark magic at their home stadium, crawled back into that game and made it basically into the last possession of the Cascades, having to hold on in their own end zone, avoiding like a Callahan that would have tied it in the final moments. Impressive win for Seattle there, but then they go on the road the next night, face off against Colorado and a very up-tempo Summit team. And the Summit took care of business at home in their home opener, 23-19 against Seattle. So Seattle now 2-1 after their first three games. I know you have some takes on Seattle. We'll get to that. Get to that in just a moment. Just wanted to run through a couple more of the scores. Chicago making their season debut, 24-9 over Detroit. It almost looked like Detroit might not clear 5 goals in that game after only getting 2 in the first half, but they did get a Callahan and some other opportunities in the second half. And then in the game of the week, game that we were maybe going to talk about a little bit on this podcast, DC at Philly. That went sideways quickly. Breeze winning 22-10 on the road. Philadelphia did not find a break in this game and just looked like a categorically different team from where we left them off last season. But this is a Philly franchise that for the past few seasons has started very, very slow. Last year, I believe they were 0-4 before they got their first win, 0-3, same with the year before. So this isn't so much of a surprise for Philly to play their worst game of the season in their first matchup, but I would say, given some of the expectations you and I had for where this roster would be, given its level of consistency in comparison to the rest of the East Division, not a great result to drop the 12-goal margin loss to the DC team. I think this officially puts the notion of it being a rivalry on pause, right? Like that's off the table for now. We got to talk about it in a different way.
100%. Well, this isn't where I was going to start, but you know what? It was the last game on the slate. We did go through the scores. So let's go ahead and start with like takeaways from this week. Let's start with that Philly DC game. Philly just completely non-competitive. It's really hard for me to know how much to take away for DC on this because there were some things I was hoping to see them do better, and they did. Like their defense converted better, they hucked it better. But looking at watching the game and seeing how non-competitive Philadelphia was, it's like really hard for me to know, you know, how much to put into how much better DC looked, because Philly just looked so poor in their performance. But it looked like Philly was lost. They abandoned their lines early. They had lines that they started the game with. It seemed like they abandoned them before they even got to halftime. So whatever lines they had set for offense and defense just like quickly went out the window. And it just seemed like there wasn't much of a plan to stick to.
I want to contribute there because it was a not great first quarter, but they were only down 2 goals. Mm-hmm. And like less than 15 game clock minutes in, so roughly 3 minutes into the second quarter, Philly just completely decided on a new rotation of offensive possessions. And like, that's fine. It just feels like after such a long offseason and for how I think consistently playable their general starting line offense was last year, to just sort of go away from that against a divisional rival that early. I totally hear you there. That was a little perplexing to me as far as an adjustment mid-game.
I don't want to spend too much time harping on this, but look, if I'm Philly, go watch the tape, because what I saw was a group of guys that looked either completely unprepared physically to play in the season. So I don't know if it was being out of shape or being just disinterested, but it just seemed like there wasn't a lot of fight there. Like defensively, I saw people standing straight up, like on the mark, not even moving when their guy was pivoting. I saw lazy attempts at poaching lanes that left their people wide open for huge swings and unders. It was just, it looked so un-Philly. Like when I think of Philly, I think of just hard work, like trying to overcome the odds, like we're this scrappy team. And I saw none of that scrappiness outside of a handful of players. Largely, it looked very not scrappy. It looked very much like rolling over when things went bad. And that's unlike this Philly team. Like even in games they've looked bad in the past, it at least felt like there was some fight in them, and it just didn't feel like that was there. So if I'm Philly, I'm taking a hard look in the mirror and figuring out, what do I need to do to just like compete better? Because it wasn't a pretty sight on Sunday.
On the flip side, DC get their first win of the season. And hats off to head coach Lauren Boyle on her first pro win. I believe that's her pro win. I feel like someone's going to correct me and be like, actually, she was a stand-in for this game in an interim way and got a win back then. But as the head coach of the Breeze, it's her first win. Hats off. Very impressive 12-goal win on the road, especially after having last week be on the road as well. Just a tough way to get your season going. I think calling a new system, and they came out fantastic. I mean, the DC offense looked exactly like I think we hypothetically envisioned it. They allowed one break attempt. Andrew Roy, I mentioned this online, he dropped a swing pass on the opening possession of their season last week against Salt Lake. Just completely uncharacteristic. I think that's the second time I've ever seen him make a mistake like that. He hasn't missed a throw or committed a turnover since. And it's just kind of been emblematic of DC. They complete 97% of their throws against Philly. They only have 9 turnovers. Their D-line was 12 of 19 on break opportunities. Cool 63% and just 12 breaks in a game. It is literally the margin of their victory. Looked a lot more impressive after squandering so many attempts in Salt Lake. In particular, I wanted to give a shout out to Isaac Lee. Without David Bloodgood back there in the defensive line, kind of leading that counterattack, I feel like he's been really energetic. He's making plays with his feet and being really stable as a possession thrower. And that's just been all the difference for the Breeze, who lacked that in their week 1 loss at Salt Lake. So really impressive win for DC. And now I think that they kind of got a little bit of this new season, new coach, down some defensive starters out of the way in the first two games. I expect them to look like the elite team that we know. And don't look now, but another one of the international phenoms in this league, Elliot Bonet, is really starting to find his rhythm, finished with 4 goals over 300 total yards, 0 turnovers, and was just unbothered running routes into deep space on any number of Philly defenders.
Oh yeah, had a really nice grab on a huck between a couple of Philly defenders. And speaking of, like, they were, what, I think DC was 6 of 7 on huck attempts. Like, that has been a thorn in their side for a couple of years now. It was a thorn in their side last week. Much improved in the deep space this game, and only 7 attempts. Like, honestly, they don't need to huck it a lot, but they just need to be efficient when they do it, and I thought they did that really right. Well, so
yeah, right. It's a changeup. Again, it's a counterpunch. It's something to give the defense another look so they can't just settle in and start attacking all of the reset passes that DC likes to do. Like, you can be as talented a thrower as DC are, but you saw the limitations of only having, small ball and mid-range looks against the shred. And that wasn't the case against Philly, very obviously, from the start. Felt like they had a very specific game plan to attack deep.
All right, I'm going to get into a couple of, like, I'm going to make some definitive statements after week two. This is very dangerous. Like, some of these are without a doubt going to come back to bite me.
Long season, man. It's a real long season.
It is.
You know better than anyone.
It is. Things can go south or north really quickly. Last year we started off 0-2 and then rattled off, like, we finished 9-3, right? So, like, things like that do happen. But I'm going to go with a couple of first one I'm going to say, Seattle is, I think, definitively right now the third best team in the West. From what I've seen so far, we've been able to see 2 games out of Oakland, 3 games out of Seattle, 2 games out of LA. That's kind of the group we were anticipating competing. I think Seattle very clearly looks like the third best team in that division.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I really like where they're kind of putting everyone, and all of their new additions are contributing right away. I mean, the returning core has upped its play. Khalif Al-Salam, Garrett Martin, Zeppelin Ronig, who currently leads the league in goals right now. I know he has 3 games as opposed to a lot of teams with only 2-1, but I mentioned it on Twitter, and I'll say it here too. He looks like somebody who could just challenge you or some other people for the goal leader this season. I mean, he is running in space. Like, he is not afraid of pretty much anyone in one-on-one matchups. He was really impressive against Kai Marshall, who is a fantastic single coverage defender. 6'5", has made some of the biggest plays at championship weekend as a defender. So to see Ronning being able to, test that kind of defender in deep space, really impressive. And then you got all another gang of just Seattle youth community studs, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this teenager that they're all really excited about, Cedar Hines, he made a block late in that game. The game wasn't quite within reach, but Noah Kuhlman was going deep for Colorado. Fantastic athlete. This teenager just murked him in the air.
Yep.
I mean, absolute, like, dunking on interception, trots up to the line and engages the defensive throwing. Like, just, I don't know, man. Seattle's got pop. Tommy Lee, he's looked like a workhorse, man. Like, he's got some pop with this new throw. He was launching at altitude in Colorado, just ripping backhands downfield and helping that Cascades offense get into their fast break looks. Like, yeah, I early going with how LA and Oakland have looked, yeah, Seattle looks like the third best team out West.
Fun fact, Garrett Martin and Zeppelin Ronig have more goals individually than Philly and Detroit have as a team. Yeah. I know they've played 3 games, but we're talking about 3 people individually. another statement I'm going to make, and this actually kind of ties into Seattle because it was one of their opponents this weekend, Colorado. Colorado making some substitutions on offense this week. Now, they were without Quinn Feiner, but they had Simran and Kuhlman playing offense, and Jay Froude moved over to defense this year. And I got to say, I love these moves. I don't know who gets subbed out when Feiner comes back and is there, but I love the moves that they made. Nethercutt looked great in this game. Not the turnovers that we've seen the last couple years in Colorado. Looked really smooth, making great decisions. I think Colorado in this game looked like after one game sample size, without Quinn Feiner, easily a top three team in the league right now. You talked about how good Carolina's looks, Salt Lake's looked good. I think Colorado is right up there after their first game performance with those teams.
They got the horses. They got their health back again. Like, Kai Marshall was one of those people who was sidelined for a lot last season, and he's just a difference maker when he's with them. Like, mm-hmm. They're just a different team when they can add another 6'5 defender, throw him and Sandy Brown and some of their other athletes, Matthew Agee. You mentioned some of the D-line players kind of getting some reps on O. Alex Tatum had a great performance playing on offense. And the person I wanted to highlight sort of in Feiner's absence, Kuhlman was great, especially I think as a distributor. His ceiling as a thrower, I think, almost exceeds his as a receiver and playmaker. And that's saying something given the kind of athleticism and highlight capabilities he has. His quick twitch continuation reads, he can really sling the thing. And I think with the stability and velocity you can get on this new Frisbee, he'll be one person to watch. But my takeaway, man, Saeed Semrin. I loved him before he got injured last year. He led the Summit in blocks as a rookie. Big boy, can run out in space. He was taking over for stretches against Seattle. He was wanting all the smoke. He was taking up lines, cuts as a receiver. He peppered in a couple of 20-yard like laser assists threading in the red zone, which is something that you just didn't see from him in games last year. I'm sure it's something that they've been seeing at practices for a while, but Colorado just sort of like developing possibly another burgeoning star to add into the fold. Like, that's something to pay attention to. And Semrin's size and speed, you know, I don't want to get too hyperbolic with comparisons as I'm prone to do, but like a little bit of Babbitt, especially in the red zone, that kind of beef moving, being able to shield out defenders, wanting to make those cuts, being aggressive, moving into that space. Like, that's a big key to having a stable offense, as we've seen with the benefits that New York gained from Babbitt and now Boston. I don't know. Semrin, man, that was a big takeaway for me from Colorado.
Yeah, they were playing Seattle on the back of the second day of a back-to-back, and it was at home. So like, I'm trying to factor all of that in, but they still looked really good. Like, everything looks so much more smooth, especially like the big thing for me was like, offensively, how are they going to look? Are they going to take care of the disc? Are they going to be, you know, they're going to take shots, but are they going to take them in spaces that make sense? Are they going to take them, or are they going to just do it too much? Like, in the first game, in a one game sample size, they look great. And we know they have the athletes. They kind of remind me of like the Empire, honestly, over the last couple of years, where it's like, often you think about all the things they have on offense, but they just have this depth of just horses they can run out there on defense. And it just seems like there's no weak link on their defensive line. Like, every person out there is capable of like double digit blocks on the season. And I think that's what another really makes them so dangerous.
Another new addition who has been like eye popping and we didn't really talk about, Mikey O'Brien from Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Evan Lepler has written about him in this week's honor roll, but he was kind of the lead horse in a lot of that defensive counterattacking. And to your point about the Seattle offense, they can suddenly attack all three levels. They're good in short spaces. When they get into red zone, they'll condense and kind of get to El Salam and Garrett Martin working in tight spaces, which is a terrific set of solvers in that kind of look. Tommy Lee and Christian Foster can absolutely rip the roof off with their deep looks. And that just makes Ronig and Khalif and Martin, who's coming back from leg surgery this offseason, so he hasn't been quite as big in space, but he can leg it out. There's a lot to like about the Cascades right now. There's a lot of opportunity there. And like you're saying, second game of a back-to-back on the road against one of the most athletic teams in Colorado, four-goal loss is pretty impressive. They did not let that get away from them. Last year, their two games, they lost by an average margin of like 10.5 goals.
Yeah,
so
they were not competitive last year.
I was just going to say Colorado blew him off the field in 2023.
Yeah. Seattle's a different team this year. And like, my last impression, and this may seem to a lot of people like a throwaway, but like, the fact that Austin took care of business the way they did against Houston speaks volumes to me, because they kind of piddled around with Dallas and Houston last year, who they were clearly better than, clearly more talented than. And I would finish playing my game And I would go check the UFA scoreboard and I'd be like, why is Dallas one goal away from Austin in the fourth quarter right now? Like, it didn't make any sense to me. Like, they were clearly like playing down. They were to their competition. They should have been winning those games handily because they were the better team. And we saw in this game right out the gate, they were like, we're the better team. We're going to stomp on your throats. And we're going to show that we're the better team. They win by 11 goals. I think that shows a lot of growth and maturity from a team that you and Daniel kind of talked about it in our preview episode, that we don't always take seriously as a top contender. And I think it is because of things like that, where they play these close games with competition that we know they're better than. They didn't let that happen. They took control of that game and never looked back. They looked like the better team from start to finish. I was really impressed with the types of deep shots they take. We know they love to throw deep, but so many of them were uncontested to open receivers, as opposed to these 50-50s and just, hey, Kyle Hinkie's down there, let's see if he can make a play. So I was really impressed with the way they played, the energy, the excitement, and just taking it to Houston. I think that speaks volumes to their growth.
Jake Radak on defense,
yeah,
letting his howitzer arm just unleash in counterattack opportunities. They returned Jake Reinhart, who I think is going to be one of the better defenders in that division, mm-hmm, if not a possible all-defense player like he was in 2022. I mean, yeah, speaking of a team with horses, Seoul look like they have a few. Like, that team can run. And as we saw, like, New York is not where they were. I feel like this year's New York team would have their hands full with the kind of team speed that the Seoul can bring, especially after watching how Atlanta handled them.
Yeah, so we've got a long season, as you mentioned earlier, but things are heating up. All teams are starting to get out there. I think by the end of next week, every team will have played at least one game, so we'll have some data on everyone.
Including you!
Yes, I'll have some personal data. We finally kick off our season this Saturday. It has felt like an eternity waiting through these first 2 weeks, seeing everyone else take the field. I cannot wait to get out there and be running around my teammates again. So, really excited.
Yeah, dude. I know it's just been eating you alive inside watching everyone go. It's the Squidward meme of him being inside and watching Patrick and SpongeBob frolic outside. You are Squidward. Just watching people celebrate, get new time with a new Frisbee. My takeaways are, it's wide open, man. It's so funny that I think, like, almost a month ago, we were all lockstep of, we would take New York over the field. I don't even know who in the field I consider a part of the field. It feels like it's really going to go almost 10-plus teams deep this year as far as who can stay healthy, who can find their optimal rotations, who can take their matchups best, and who can kind of get some tough road wins. I think that is going to be a big part. And these Super Series matchups, these interdivisional games, like, suddenly that Colorado road trip through Madison and Minnesota, just given the way that there's so much uncertainty about this year, like, that's a big thing. You know, Salt Lake, they get two wins this past weekend, but anyone who watched those games, San Diego was punching with them on Friday night. Travis Dunn wasn't going anywhere in that fourth quarter. Mm-mm. I mean, Salt Lake kind of had to tough that one out. They were condensed down to what is kind of their bedrock best version of themselves, a red zone team. But San Diego did a great job against them. And then the next night, you know, they go up big in the first quarter, 8-2 on LA. Aviators won the back three quarters of that game. This road trip for them through Oakland and Colorado in 2 weeks is going to be a big deal. So we'll get into all that stuff as we continue to progress into the season. But that'll do it for this week to recap episode of Swing Pass. We'll be back with you in a couple days to preview the upcoming week 3 slate of games, including a rematch between Atlanta and Carolina that just grows tastier by the day. Thank you all listening for so much. We'll talk to you soon. Bye now.